you see alerts like this, you see notifications like this, understand that this is not something personal. It is largely driven by your geographic location, which you are not responsible for, right? So be vigilant, keep your defenses up. And I'm trying to appeal to my blue teamers here. Just keep an eye on what's happening out there and stuff like that. And implement IOCs, implement detections when you can. Turn your logs up a little bit. Make sure folks are paying attention and stuff like that. And if you, if you do business in these parts of the world and you know that, then put extra shields on. That's really what I want to get across here.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast Weekly Intel Chat. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. Joining me today to break down the cybersecurity news being shared by the awesome InfoSec community is the one and only Matt Bromley. And don't forget, this podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for security operations. Think of it as a backend for your MSSP, where everything is built API first. Scale with ease and confidence as your business grows. You can start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. How are you doing today, Matt Bromley?
There he is, Chris. I'm doing well, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. It's been sunny the last couple days. Feel a little weird, feel like I'm working a lot, but not getting a lot done. I don't know if that makes sense.
You must be an AI agent. I think that's how they feel.
things are good. The world looked like it was getting a little better yesterday, and then now it sounds like we're not. Iran continues to be at the top of the charts. We're always kind of a week behind with our reporting, given the time from when we record to when the episode gets published.
Yeah.
For the listeners, just to get some context, yesterday was Tuesday when there was a ceasefire announced, and today it looks like that might be coming to an end because of some unfolding events. So I'm not sure what it's going to look like by the time folks hear this, but it's certainly not finished, and there's a layer of unease in the world I can kind of feel out there.
I feel like this is a continuous effort where we are constantly looking for ways to deal with the ongoing stress, mm-hmm. if you will, right? Maybe according to all the algorithms on various things and what I hear people talking about at the gym, which is very odd. Maybe the world cortisol level is very high, Chris. Everyone's talking about cortisol these days. And I feel like it's, if you read the situation and things like that, you know what I mean? Maybe that's what it is it's just that the level of stress is higher for everybody.
Yeah, I had to do some driving around town yesterday, and I felt like everybody's patience and general anxiety levels were high. So maybe that's what it is. The algorithm's just pumping our cortisol levels right through the roof.
It's possible. And maybe that's the goal, right? Maybe everyone's on edge all the time. So we make bad decisions. I don't know. Like
shopping. Buy more stuff.
Yeah, shopping seems to be up, you know? It's funny. Netflix raises the price by like $3 and it's a social media outcry. And I feel like if Anthropic doubled their subscription, a lot of people would be like, It's like, all right, well, okay. The money's there. It's just the value that you're getting out of it, I suppose. We're here to talk about.
Yeah, I got one more though. One of the things that really got me yesterday was, I think maybe CNBC, I don't want to put them on blast, but I think that's who it was. I was watching a report on there, and the woman basically was quoting President Trump in his threat to end a civilization, immediately followed by, do you think the investors will see this as up or down in the market?
Yeah.
I think we're doing something wrong.
There's a lot of ways of looking at it. I mean, that message in itself is not one that you want to have any world leader send out, let alone thinking, right?
Yeah.
Number one, and that obviously relates to what we've got in our first article here. But the other side of it is, the types of moves that do get made. You know, Chris, one thing we don't talk about on this podcast by design, because you and I have enough fun balanced with enough amount of world stress, what we don't need to get into is, you know, some of these tweets or these truths or whatever come out. And I mean, they do swing billion-dollar markets. They do make billion-dollar moves. And I'm not here advertising, try to ride the wave of those, but more about, you know, looking at, I mean, I'm literally sitting here talking to you and I just got a notification that the Strait of Hormuz has been closed again. And it's kind of one of those, like the moment you and I, we started recording 4 minutes ago and 4 minutes in, you know, like the world changes. And I think that's the big focus. That's the difference here is it's the change is more apparent and it's in our face a lot more than it used to be. You know, and one of the things there's a few comedians who have talked about this, but there's and I always use comedy as a reference. I feel like comedians do a very good job of representing the real state of the world to us so that it's easier to handle from a humorous perspective. But there's a joke kind of being made about how most wars and battles and things like that these days, they're all fought not on the internet from a cybersecurity perspective, but everything is on camera now, right? Mm-hmm. Everything is on camera. And I would almost like to question the number of cameras in the world against the number of grains of sand in the world, because like when you just think about the sheer proliferation of how many cameras there are out there, and then there is no more waiting for tomorrow's headlines. That idea is gone. I mean, in the past four, you know, almost 5 minutes now that you and I have been talking during our introduction here, I've gotten three updates on the ongoing conflict over there. And this is not including what's happening in Ukraine. Like that's still going on, believe it or not. It's not including what's happening in other parts of the world. And all I really want to see right now is what the Artemis is up to. And that's the other side of it is what I want to see versus what I don't see. You know, I'm going to date myself a little bit here, but Chris, there used to be a day where you could be like, I'm not going to read the front page. I'm going to read the style section first to ease my mind. It's very difficult to make that choice now, because it's just wow, wow at you all the time. And I think that ties into the level of stress. But sir, you and I are not psychologists, but someone here is going to spend a lot of time on what you and I just broke down in 5 minutes.
yeah. Let's get to the business at hand.
Oh, come on. That was fun.
No, it was really fun. We might have to start a side project podcast just to
rant.
There
we go.
Yeah
good thing you and I have a ton of free time.
Two middle-aged men rant at the sky for 20 minutes once
a week. Hey, come on. Neither of us are middle-aged. We have at least a few more years before we're middle-aged.
All right. Middle age, that would be optimistic. Okay. Federal cybersecurity agencies have issued an urgent warning about Iran-linked cyber attacks targeting operational technology assets across U.S. critical infrastructure, according to a joint advisory from the FBI, CISA, NSA, DOE, EPA, and U.S. Cyber Command. Recent attacks have disrupted organizations and sectors, including government facilities, water and wastewater utilities, and energy systems. The attackers are focusing on internet-exposed programmable logic controllers, or PLCs, particularly devices manufactured by Rockwell Automation / Allen Bradley, though other vendors may also be vulnerable. The attacks involve direct manipulation of industrial control systems, including project files and data displayed on human-machine interface and SCADA systems. These changes can disrupt operational processes and interfere with the monitoring systems used by operators to manage industrial environments. Because PLCs are widely deployed throughout critical infrastructure, federal agencies warn that similar attacks could affect additional organizations if vulnerabilities remain unaddressed. The advisory urges operators to review indicators of compromise and examine their networks for signs of both current and past activity. Investigators say the activity resembles previous campaigns attributed to Iran-linked hacking group Cyber Avengers, which is associated with Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The group has previously targeted water utilities in the United States and internationally. In one case, an attack on a water utility in Ireland disrupted service for 2 days. Cyber Avengers has also been connected to operations against U.S. water facilities and other industrial control systems. The campaign appears to be part of a broader escalation of Iran-linked cyber operations. Other groups associated with Iran have recently increased activity targeting U.S. organizations. The Handala hacking group reportedly wiped more than 200,000 devices belonging to medical technology company Stryker and was also linked to the compromise of the personal email account of FBI Director Kash Patel, though officials said no government data was exposed. U.S. authorities have also offered rewards of up to $10 million for information about members of the Iranian group Eminent Passive Guard? Yeah, we'll go with that. Federal agencies are advising organizations that operate industrial control systems to assume they could be targeted and to proactively assess their OT environments for vulnerabilities. Because many PLC devices are accessible from the public internet, attackers can interact directly with industrial control systems if security controls are weak or misconfigured, increasing the risk of operational disruption across critical infrastructure sectors. So yeah, not a big surprise based on what we were talking about earlier, but I do want to call out here, I thought the Stryker initially reported 10,000 devices being wiped, and now they're reporting 200,000 devices being wiped. That is wild.
Yeah, Chris, articles like this, I think, are going to continue to kind of make an appearance in the show here over the past few weeks. There's definitely been a lot of focus and a lot of attention spent on what's happening over in Iran. Whenever I've talked to folks about Iranian threat actors or APT or state nexus threat actors and whatnot, I'm no CTI expert, but one of the trends that we've always observed has been a propensity for, or affinity maybe is the best word, if that's even a word, affinity is for hacktivist style attacks. You know, a lot of times Iranian APT threat actors have been associated with website takedowns and destruction and DDoSing and things like that. We can go all the way back to Shamoon for these if we want to, of, you know, wiping out Saudi Aramco. And there's situations like this where now that they're in active warfare, the magnifying glass gets bigger, number one, right? Number two, the target becomes, I think, forgive me for my words here, but the potential targets become much richer, if you will. You're no longer doing it as an act of provocation. You're doing it as an act of retaliation. And I feel, you know, very much, and I akin this, I spoke to someone about this yesterday, Chris, I akin a lot of it to kind of like a bar fight, as weird as that may sound, right? When you are, or when someone's in a bar looking to pick a fight, they might pick a fight with really anyone, you know, if they're really looking to fight, but usually they're probably going to go after like a weaker target or something like that. But it's always tough to make that first move if you're a provocative threat actor or hacktivist group. But if you're retaliating, you're responding to a punch, well, then it's all, I mean, you could just start swinging and whatever happens, wherever you hit. So there's situations like this where, you know, Stryker, I mean, is just one of potentially many organizations where it's like, hey, you do business with this country. You are based in this country and so on and so forth. We don't like it. We're retaliating because you're there. We talked about the data center bombings or disruptions a few weeks ago, right? I mean, it's very odd to me. It's odd, but it also makes sense. But it's very weird to me for an organization to be like, all right, we're going to take out their data centers. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, do you also like have data centers? Like, it's just one of those like backbone things where is it company association? Is it where the headquarters is? Is it what data transits through it and stuff like that, you know? And then you get situations where they're going, I mean, I remember when this conflict started, they went after a hotel in Dubai, and that's kinetic, not cyber, but I'm using that as an example to say when it's retaliatory, especially from a cybersecurity perspective, it's anyone's game. It's wide open. And for defenders out there who are listening, this increases the chances that you might suffer. And neither Chris nor I are saying here, like, all right, everyone watch out. It's not a question of if, but when, right? It's not what we're saying at all. But the U.S. government is coming out with a list of IOCs. They're coming out with some very specific information. They're like, hey, if you're in a critical infrastructure, a PLC style environment, SCADA style environment, and things like that, OT style environments, if you will, watch out, mm-hmm. because we're seeing this group come after these types of things. And where I'm going with this, Chris, from a blue team perspective, is it's really the only thing that matters here is you're based in the U.S., as weird as that sounds. So I'm asking everyone inside of these sectors, like, to take these things seriously, be vigilant and stuff like that. You know, it's really all gloves are off, and anyone is vulnerable just because they're in the U.S. And a victory, or not victory, but an attack against a major city or a small town would all yield a success checkbox on their side. So everyone be vigilant and just watch out. That's what I'm trying to really get across here is, you see alerts like this, you see notifications like this, understand that this is not something personal. It is largely driven by your geographic location, which you are not responsible for, right? So be vigilant, keep your defenses up. And I'm trying to appeal to my blue teamers here. Just keep an eye on what's happening out there and stuff like that. And implement IOCs, implement detections when you can. Turn your logs up a little bit. Make sure folks are paying attention and stuff like that. And if you do business in these parts of the world and you know that, then put extra shields on. That's really what I want to get across here.
Yeah, and it's probably not going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah, that as well.
All right. So next up, another geopolitical interesting development. A hacker operating under the alias Flaming China claims to have breached a Chinese state-run supercomputing facility and stolen a large data set that may exceed 10 petabytes of information. The data is believed to originate from the National Supercomputing Center, NSCC, in Tianjin, a major computing hub that provides infrastructure services to more than 6,000 organizations across China, including research institutions, scientific programs, and defense-related entities. According to cybersecurity experts who reviewed sample files released by the attacker, the leaked materials appear to contain a wide range of research outputs, including aerospace engineering work, military research, fusion simulations, and bioinformatics data. The samples reportedly include files labeled secret in Chinese, along with technical simulations and renderings of military hardware such as bombs and missiles. The hacker posted a preview of the dataset on an anonymous Telegram channel on February 6th and is offering limited access to samples for several thousand dollars. Full access to the entire dataset is allegedly being sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars, with payment requested in cryptocurrency. The hacker claims that the stolen information is associated with major Chinese organizations, including the Aviation Industry Corporation of China, the Commercial Aircraft Corporation of China, and the National University of Defense Technology. While the claims have not been independently verified, several cybersecurity specialists who reviewed the available samples said the materials appear consistent with the type of data stored in a large national supercomputing facility. According to one cybersecurity researcher who communicated directly with the alleged attacker, the breach was achieved through a compromised VPN domain that provided access to the supercomputing network. After gaining entry, the attacker reportedly deployed a botnet, an automated network of systems, to extract data from multiple servers simultaneously. This distributed extraction process reportedly took about 6 months to complete and allowed the attacker to move small amounts of data from different machines at once, reducing the likelihood of triggering security alerts. Experts noted that the technique was effective but not technically unusual, suggesting that the success of the breach may have been due more to system architecture and monitoring gaps than to advanced hacking methods. Researchers say the scale of the dataset could make it particularly valuable to intelligence agencies, with 1 petabyte equal to roughly 1,000 terabytes, far beyond the storage capacity of a typical laptop. Analyzing the full dataset would require significant computing resources. Because of this, analysts believe nation-state intelligence organizations are among the few actors capable of processing the information at scale and extracting meaningful insights from it. If confirmed, the incident would highlight broader cybersecurity weaknesses in China's digital infrastructure. Experts cited previous large-scale exposures, including a database containing personal information on up to 1 billion Chinese citizens that was left publicly accessible for more than a year before being discovered. Chinese policymakers have acknowledged these challenges as well. The country's 2025 National Security White Paper emphasized the need to strengthen protections for networks, data systems, and artificial intelligence infrastructure as China continues competing globally in advanced technology and computing. Sounds pretty major. And I got to say, honestly, it's kind of nice to hear they have the same problems we do over here.
Chris, I tell you what captivated me about this article is this 10 petabytes walking out the door. I did some really quick cocktail napkin math between myself and Gemini. And we found out that, not found out, I don't know how true this is, but it would cost about $25,000 to buy hard drives to be a petabyte. Then you need to run them, right? But then I'm looking at this kind of like, it took us, us might be the wrong reference here, but the extraction of 10 petabytes of data took around 6 months. Where are you putting that? This is the part that just seems odd to me I don't know. I'm at that point where I'm not disagreeing with the adversary. Please, if you're listening, adversary, don't take it that way. But this is one of those situations, Chris, where you and I are talking about a password dump and it's 4 billion passwords revealed and that kind of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but did you dedupe it? What is this? 10 petabytes of data from a supercomputer system. I don't deny that 10 petabytes of data exists around the world and whatnot, but it just really, what do you do with that? I mean, here's my thing. Where do you put that? Do you store in the cloud? So in that case, what cloud provider out there is like, oh yeah, I got one guy consuming 10 petabytes. Maybe that's normal. Maybe I'm wrong. Like maybe, yeah. Like maybe Netflix is like, that's a Wednesday afternoon to us, you know? I don't know. But I guess I'm just curious when I hear these types of things out there. But to your point, yeah, man, we're not alone in the world. Everybody gets hacked.
Yeah. I didn't even think about how ridiculous that large of a data set is. 10 petabytes. I guess you got a lot of old spinning drives kicking around.
I guess so. Like, I mean, you go and you just like raid a few Western Digitals over the course of a few years and then you hook them all up to what? Like, I mean, this is okay. So imagine this. Let's say we operate off of 25 terabyte drives. We would need 4,000 of those, right? If I'm not mistaken, 25 minus 40, I think. Yeah, four. That's 1,000. Okay, that's a petabyte. So we would need 4,000 25 terabyte drives, which is the top tier of storage there. Cost aside, my friend, where are you plugging in 4,000 hard drives? That's not a data center. So like, okay, which data center in the world is holding this stuff?
Okay, so I had to check back because I remember when they imaged the black hole a few years ago. I mean, a few years ago, it's like 2017. But that was 5 petabytes of data.
Yeah.
So okay. This is double that.
Wait, when was this? Sorry, which one?
In 2017, there was that woman researcher who gave us the first image of an actual black hole. I don't know if you remember that.
It was pretty
nerdy news. Yeah,
Yes. Oh, no, I 100% remember that. Yeah, I remember the picture too, where she was like, Yeah.
Yeah, so from that article, it has a couple little... So this is half of what this guy got. It said the data is equivalent to roughly 5,000 years of MP3 audio or 75 times the total data of the entire Google Earth database. So
a lot
of data. Yeah.
See what I mean? Like, it seems... I don't know, man. It's just a little odd. And I don't mean to argue with the journalist who put this article together. It just, to me, I would have been like, really? 10 petabytes? Like, bro, show me a file listing. Mm-hmm. Like, give me an LS right now. Let me see it. Like, all right, it'd be an LL technically or LS-L, but like, let me see it.
I'm sure it's a lot of simulation data, especially if it's like aerodynamic stuff. So it's probably just lots of raw data, not documents.
That's my thought.
Like,
is
that.
It? Yeah. It doesn't make much sense. And maybe they got it compressed. That's the other thing I've seen happen before too, where someone's like, oh, I stole 2 terabytes of data. And you're like, if you expand it, it's 2 terabytes, but whatever. But to me, that part was just wildly interesting. And that's one of the first things where I went to, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So I grabbed this one from Zach Allen's great weekly newsletter, Detection Engineering Weekly. Definitely seems like something we've been talking about and something folks should pay attention to. So multiple high-profile maintainers in the Node.js ecosystem report being targeted in a coordinated social engineering campaign aimed at compromising widely used open source packages. The activity surfaced during investigations into the compromise of the HTTP client library Axios and appears to follow a repeatable pattern targeting maintainers responsible for highly trusted NPM packages. Developers connect to widely used projects such as Lodash, .env, Fastify, and core ECMA scripts. Polyfills reported similar contact attempts. Because these packages receive billions of downloads each month, the compromised maintainer account could provide attackers with a direct path into the global software supply chain. Attackers typically initiate contact through professional platforms like LinkedIn or Slack, while posing as representatives of legitimate companies. After building rapport over several weeks, they invite the target to participate in a scheduled video call. The meeting environment is designed to closely mimic legitimate conferencing platforms such as Microsoft Teams or streaming services. Once the call begins, the interface displays what appears to be a technical issue with audio or system configuration and prompts the user to install software or run a command to resolve the problem. In several cases documented by maintainers, the downloaded application contained information-stealing malware. The malware functions as a remote access trojan that establishes persistent control over the compromised machine. After installation, it collects system data and periodically communicates with attacker infrastructure. Because the attack occurs after the user has already authenticated, protections such as two-factor authentication do not prevent credential theft. The malware can extract locally stored secrets, including NPM registry tokens, browser session cookies, AWS credentials, and other authentication artifacts. With access to those tokens, attackers can publish malicious updates to NPM packages without needing to bypass additional authentication controls. Security researchers believe the campaign is connected to a threat actor tracked by Mandiant as UNC1069, previously known for targeting cryptocurrency companies and venture capital firms. The group relies on long-term social engineering designed to appear routine rather than urgent. Their infrastructure includes spoofed meeting interfaces built using legitimate software components from services like Zoom and Microsoft Teams. And in some cases, the attackers may use AI-generated video to impersonate the interviewers. Researchers warn that targeting open-source maintainers represents a strategic shift towards software supply chain compromise. The NPM registry processes trillions of downloads each year, and core dependencies are embedded across developer tools, CI pipelines, and enterprise applications. A malicious update to a widely used package could propagate rapidly through automated dependency resolution and reach millions of systems within hours, creating a cascading downstream effect across a broader ecosystem. So yeah, this is the stuff of nightmares, man.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I kind of feel like we're seeing the reconnaissance and initial access / exploitation stages of some of these things, right? This is what it looks like when they get in. We're seeing folks kind of talk about like, hey, I just realized I was part of this as well. Goes to show you, you know, I think we had kind of called out or talked about before how the Axios hack was likely a result of some of the additional compromises that we had seen before. The threat actor is slipping my mind at the moment. But kind of these long tail effects of how these adversaries compromise these groups and whatnot, which I think then goes into, you know, like you got to be vigilant everywhere. But for these developers, for these package maintainers, these source code maintainers, whatever you want to call them, they've got so many different moving pieces happening, Chris, that they become very ripe targets. And this is how the adversary, like how dialed in the adversaries are. I think when folks hear about package compromise and software supply chain compromise and things like that, your mind often goes towards like, oh, you know, someone inserted a malicious PR, that PR got approved, and then the malicious code went out. And it's like, no, they are social engineering. They're trying to get into the channels. They're trying to get into the dev life cycles. They are going after maintainers. They are trying to get into the maintainer's head. They are like, hey, can you join my thing? Can you give me permissions? Can you do this? Can you do that? They're doing everything they can to try and get that relationship formed and or get access to various pieces of code, including, you know, as we've seen before, just calling it out right here, a legitimate company doing some guerrilla marketing, download and install some software and things like that. And I mean, it's one of those situations where, of course, because of Axios, everyone is on full alert, watching out for stuff to be happening. But when you zoom in a little bit further, you're like, well, I mean, how did they get into the other ones? And now we kind of see behind the scenes. So I love the fact that from a kill chain perspective, we're seeing some of those initial stages, right? What it looks like. A lot of times we see after the fact, okay, the adversary installed a malicious, you know, a script that does a thing and they did this, they did that and whatnot. But in here, and there's a technical detailed breakdown of how it all works and whatnot. But I just think it's wildly fascinating. Has been attributed to some North Korean threat actors and whatnot. But, you know, Chris, if I can zoom out for 30 seconds here, you look at these like technical support, not scams, but like technical support jobs, fake interview hires, heavy reliance on AI, heavy reliance on social engineering, on phishing, on getting integrated into software development life cycles. Like, North Korean threat actors are really, pardon my words here, listeners, have really upped their perception and understanding of how to infiltrate. And I'm not going to say it's not like it's a masterclass or anything like that, but they're very versatile in how they do what they do and how they get there. And I think there's a lot for defenders to learn. There's also a lot of transitive security that's got to be shared out there, not via osmosis, but if you're a package maintainer. And this is a discussion I had with students in my class last week, Chris, was when you consider what a high value target looks like inside of your organization, a lot of IT security folks are very quick to say, oh, you know, my executives and my IT admins and my domain admins and stuff like that. And I would say your high value targets are anyone who can have an impact on something that is public facing that you release out to the world. And that's pretty much it. And developers fall in that life cycle, right? We saw it with LastPass. We see it all the time with software supply chain compromises. Developers have a direct link into products you build and ship out. In fact, I would argue that's more impactful than a CEO or a CFO, you know? And it's always been like, oh, don't let these things get compromised. And it's like, that's not your biggest concern, number one. And then number two is, while we're on this topic, we've also thrown out this idea in here about marketing and anyone who has keys to the social media account also being a high value target. And I find that to be an interesting cross section because in this discussion here, I think it was Matteo Colina, who's the co-founder and CTO of Platformatic, part of the Node.js technical steering committee and everything like that, mentioned that it was a company doing some guerrilla marketing and stuff. So like these, you know, this is not install our brand new security software. This is not, hey, click in to check your email and stuff like that. It is someone trying to appeal to the marketing side of a co-founder of a CTO and be like, hey man, check out this new thing we're doing. Like this is all executive public facing speak, Chris. None of this is, hey, check out this PR with this super complicated code. Hopefully you won't understand it. It's all very high level, connect, boom, low level technical attack swoops in. And that's going to change the game for some defenders out there. And you need a user education is going to be your best friend.
And I also think this is one of those areas where we're going to see AI multiply the threat because, you know, through this NPM downstream sort of supply chain attack, yeah, you get access to millions of systems within hours, which previously you still had a human who had to kind of go identify the targets and figure out which ones to spend the effort. There's only so much they can automate, but almost immediately you could use AI in this process to identify where the high value targets are and initially start whatever the next steps are for the attack plan there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Speaking of fast AI assisted things, Microsoft Threat Intelligence reports that the cybercrime group Storm 1175 is conducting rapid ransomware campaigns, deploying the Medusa ransomware family. The group's operations focus on exploiting newly discovered vulnerabilities during the short window between the public disclosure and widespread patch adoption. According to Microsoft, attackers frequently move from initial vulnerability exploitation to data exfiltration and ransomware deployment with only a few days, and in some cases within 24 hours, highlighting the importance of immediate patching once security updates are released. Storm 1175 primarily targets exposed internet-facing infrastructure and has impacted organizations in sectors including healthcare, education, professional services, and finance across the United States, United Kingdom, and Australia. The group has exploited more than a dozen known vulnerabilities commonly referred to as end-day vulnerabilities, which are flaws that already have patches available but have not yet been widely applied. One example is CVE-2026-1731, a remote code execution vulnerability in Beyond Trust remote support and older versions of its privileged remote access product. The vulnerability was discovered in early February and quickly appeared in active attacks, prompting the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, to add it to the known exploited vulnerabilities or KEV catalog. The attackers have also exploited other widely known vulnerabilities affecting JetBrains, TeamCity, and CrushFTP. In addition to end-day vulnerabilities, Microsoft linked the group to exploitation of several zero-day vulnerabilities in Smarter Mail and GoAnywhere Managed File Transfer. In both cases, exploitation occurred roughly a week before the vulnerabilities were publicly disclosed, suggesting either internal exploit development capability or access to exploit brokers. Despite this, researchers say the group still relies primarily on rapidly weaponizing known vulnerabilities rather than developing new exploits. Once inside a network, Storm 1175 uses several common post-exploitation tools and techniques. Remote monitoring and management software is used to move laterally across systems. Impacket is used for credential dumping, and rclone is used to exfiltrate data. Microsoft also observed the group modifying Windows Defender antivirus settings through the Windows registry to disable scanning of the system drive. This allows Medusa ransomware payloads to execute without triggering security alerts. Because these changes require elevated privileges, a credential theft phase of the attack is critical to gaining administrative access. Microsoft recommends that organizations enable Defender tamper protection, use the disable local admin merge setting to prevent local administrators from modifying antivirus exclusions, and deploy credential guard to protect credentials stored in memory. The company also advises isolating web-facing systems and placing publicly accessible servers behind web application firewalls or DMZ infrastructure to reduce exposure to rapid exploitation campaigns. So yeah, spawn camping the CVE list.
Yeah, I mean, this one is, we haven't talked about ransomware in a little bit, actually. This one is interesting to see come back up. I think the part that I wanted to zoom in on the most for defenders here is this little bit right here. Using RMM software for lateral movement, I think, is approach or tactic or technique or, you know, tooling that we see adversaries use. Number one, for anyone who's been in security, hopefully you have an RMM kind of policy and stuff locked down inside of your environment and whatnot. You definitely want to make sure that, you know, you are watching out for RMM tools, both approved and unapproved RMM tools. And if you don't know what is on both of those lists, or at least on the approved list, mark that as a priority. Go and figure that out, number one. But then, Chris, getting into Impacket for credential dumping and then using rclone for data exfiltration is kind of an interesting set of tools. You don't really see these tools, maybe Impacket more, but you don't really see rclone show up that much from an exfiltration perspective. It's interestingly a way to like guarantee integrity and data transfer resuming and stuff like that, which I find interesting. Whenever you see an adversary use rsync, it's like, oh, you wanted a pause button just in case something happens, right? in situations, and it's not to say I've never seen these things before, but it's just not tools that we hear and talk about that much. So I think in this case, right, it's interesting to kind of see the flow from an adversarial TTP perspective. But then getting into how they're using some of the different tooling and kind of how that changes up. But really, to your point earlier, the big focus obviously is how quickly they're able to weaponize these. Exploitation of end days and zero days has become kind of commonplace for this organization here, as Microsoft noted, more than a dozen known vulnerabilities or end days, some of them stemming very quickly to things like execution RCE flaws and Beyond Trust remote support. Different things here. And sorry, I'm kind of zooming in as I step through this. JetBrains, Crush FTP, Microsoft Exchange vulnerabilities. Like, when you get a threat actor who's very up to speed on how to take advantage of vulnerable environments and vulnerable software, it makes them very powerful, and AI can lower the bar for them. You know, you don't go to AI, you say, hey, find me a zero day, although apparently...
did you read the Anthropic article?
Yeah, apparently Anthropic Mythos can do that, as long as you have 27-year-old BSD running. But jokes aside, it's not a thing you can go to a AI with and say, hey, help me find a vulnerability. But you can bring in the CVSS details and say, tell me about this, research, find me out how this works, describe to me how it works. And if you understand how it works, you can understand how to reverse engineer it. And I think that's where groups like this will level up immensely, is because they can not only get maybe inside action or inside preview, but they can weaponize faster than anybody else can. So a wild combination of events here. And again, we haven't talked about ransomware in a while, but it's interesting to see how the adversarial approaches are changing and maturing, honestly.
I did find it a little bit amusing how the article talks about, you know, before people can get patches applied in the first few days. I'm like, we see people compromise years after patches are pushed out. So
there's a little bit of an assumption there, you know. You haven't patched in 2 days. What are you doing?
Yeah. So you haven't said it for a while, Matt. Are you going to do the thing?
Patch. Patch for your stuff. No, this is tough. I think the velocity with which you will see adversaries weaponize is going to get even faster as time goes on. So patch just needs to be like living and breathing, not so much, maybe patch faster, but it's got to just be a full-time job maybe.
Yeah. Or build a robot to do it.
Those go one in the same, sir. I don't want a human doing that type of stuff at all.
Oh man, more robots.
Bring them
right. On. Yeah. All right. So great chatting again. Hopefully the world looks a little brighter next week when we talk.
Hopefully. Likewise, Chris. Always good seeing you.
Yeah. Take care, sir.
Bye.
And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend or subscribing and giving us a rating or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake, with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.